Coming up on Tech Nation, we all check out the weather, and that's part of being human. But now that we've been experiencing severe weather events, is there more of an impact on us than we realize? Clayton Page Aldern says yes. He's the author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Then, this year, some 240,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer, and 70% will be what's called ER-positive, HER2-negative. Dr. Sean Bowen from Olema Oncology tells us about their approach, along with the unexpected crossover to prostate cancer. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2012, I interviewed Harvard professor and experimental psychologist Steven Pinker, the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. He writes, "In every era, the way people raise their children is a window into their conception of human nature."
Well, when people believed that children were possessed by the devil, they had to beat the devil out of them, quite literally. And you had high rates of corporal punishment of children. When you have a different conception, that children are blank slates written on by their parents and culture, then childhood is filled with lessons for moral improvement and constant stimulation. When empathy is considered the cardinal virtue, then you've got to raise the empathic child. So I introduced that observation after I heard a mother admonishing a fussy child who's picking on his kid sister. Empathy? Yeah. I take that as a sign of the times of how empathy is now valued as the one of the cardinal virtues.
We've understood this in science about how we thought blood worked this way and it worked that way. Yeah. What were the laws of physics? All these kind of things that we didn't know. But it never occurred to me that we've actually had this perspective of what human nature was like, and that, in fact, that ended up affecting everything else.
That's right. And the there is a romantic conception of human nature, that we're naturally cooperative and peaceful. If we could only return to a state of nature, the world's troubles would melt away. It's our institutions that have made us more violent by defining private property, by setting up laws and then enforcing them. The overall sweep of history, I think, goes in the other direction, that, in fact, our species has always been violent for as long as we've been human, that there were, in fact, far higher rates of violence in earlier periods when we lived beyond, without states, before states were invented, or in parts of the world that lived beyond the reach of states, and that human history has very largely been a process of keeping our devils under control, and that our institutions have made us less violent. So it's not neither that human nature is innately peaceable. Our ancestors certainly weren't. Nor is it that we have an innate thirst for blood, a violent brain, you know, killer ape DNA that dooms us to violence forever, because we do have cognitive mechanisms that are, over the long run, clever enough to figure out ways of inhibiting violence. And the course of human history is we've been getting better and better at doing it.
It's really very interesting. I was thinking there's a person that we all work with, a colleague, who came from a very distrusting family and with two boys. And when it came to, say, a single piece of cake, it was one cuts, the other picks. Instead of who needs to get what done and who could do it, it was like, well, we're going to measure how, and then somebody else is going to pick it. We're like, where did this all come from? You're screwing everything up.
Well, you know, one divides, the other picks is an excellent example of how we think of conflict as a problem to be solved. We take into account a feature of human nature, namely, people tend to be biased in favor of themselves, and they don't realize it. They always think they're doing the right, just thing. But
they've explained it in that way. But in fact, yeah, it works for them.
Exactly, it works for them. And so, if you just have the rule, one divides, the other chooses, then even if people are selfish, you'll end up with a fair outcome. Because if the divider hopes to get the bigger piece and divides it unevenly in anticipation, he'll just end up worse off. And so, no one one has to be particularly noble or angelic. We've just used our ingenuity to come up with a scheme that will reduce conflict even with our flawed natures. And so I think that's a very good encapsulation of what's happened over the course of human history.
You've been listening to a 2012 Tech Nation interview with experimental psychologist Steven Pinker, the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. He remains the John Stone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, and in 2016, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Rhodes Scholar and environmental journalist Clayton Page Aldern. He talks about our emotional and psychological responses to our recent experiences with severe weather events and how public policy is likely missing the mark. Then, 70% of breast cancers are what's called ER-positive, HER2-negative. Dr. Sean Bowen from Olema Oncology talks about what they've learned and what they are doing, as well as how this relates to prostate cancer.
Tech Nation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Clayton Page Aldern. Clayton, welcome to Tech Nation.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Whether we live in a nature preserve or in the middle of a city teeming with people, we all pretty much start every day with a personal relationship with the weather. You know, it might be you go to the window, you might look at your phone, you look at the, hey, what time of year is it? This has always been true for humans.
Always. And I would go as far as to say it's not just the weather, right? It's the environment writ large. It is always all around us all the time. And to that extent, it's like a fish living in water. It's always there and you may not notice it every moment of every day, but that doesn't mean that it isn't bearing some kind of influence on you.
And not just what you're wearing or what you might wear later in the day. And there's also always prediction about this. Well, it's raining now. Is it going to keep raining? It's not raining now. Will it rain? But it's also how you feel about it. It's like, it's going to rain. I can't take another day of rain.
Yeah, right. Or
there's an emotional response.
Indeed, right. Or in my case, living in Seattle, the rain is something that makes me feel a little blasé, right? It is relentless. It is always there, past the point of getting up in arms about it. But it tends to act on my emotional experience insofar as I look outside, it's cloudy again, look at the drizzle, man, another one of those. And so my reaction to the rain might look different from somebody else's, but there's no escaping the fact that we are indeed emotionally linked to the weather around us and the environment writ large.
Now let's get into what's been happening lately. I mean, it's just really been perhaps in the last 5-10 years that if there was some weather event that was unusual, you'd go, well, that's climate change. But now we truly are experiencing more serious wildfires, hurricanes, heat waves, flooding, drought, you name it. But before we get into some specifics, looking overall, your message here is that all of these changes impact us as individuals.
Yes. And I think this is the manner in which that individual context perhaps falls to the wayside. The fact that you might enjoy the rain and I might feel a little blasé when it comes down versus some shared neurobiological response that we might all have at the individual level, but in our shared humanity to something like a heat wave or something like a wildfire, right? It is a near universal human response that our brains aren't that great at handling extreme heat. They're not that great at handling exposure to smoke and air pollution. And so while we feel those types of impacts at the individual level, there's more of a shared experience there. And it's this shared experience that I'm a bit more worried about.
You have again and again brought us back to in the book that, boy, a real hot weather event, a real heat wave. You know, there's all kinds of things that happen. Increased violence, decision-making goes off. How do you determine that decision-making has gone a kilter, shall we say?
Yeah, well, we know this from a variety of fields. Behavioral economists have looked at the impact of extreme heat on problem solving and decision making and critical thinking for decades, right? And everywhere they look, and in whatever sector, whether it's the decisions made by immigration judges on hot days, or the decisions made by chess players when it's warmer outside, from the individual student to the politician making speeches on the legislative floor, right? Extreme heat does appear, according to these economists, to bear on the complexity of thought that we're able to communicate, right? And the complexity of decision we're able to make. And that's one academic field. We also know from cognitive neuroscience research that extreme heat affects the brain areas that are responsible for those kinds of things. We know from neurobiological research at the cellular level that extreme heat affects the ability of neurons to cope effectively, right? And so there's this intertwining of various threads of academic research that point in the direction of, you know, heat is just not that great for our brains when it comes to problem solving.
I like your words when you wrote, this is about the neuroscience and psychology, not just neuroscience, not just psychology, the two brought together of how a changing world changes us from the inside out. You've been talking about hot weather. Well, that's just that day. What about over time?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when I talk about the environment changing us from the inside out, I want to make clear, I am indeed talking about these somewhat more squishy psychological and emotional effects, these things that we can name, but perhaps they're a little hard to pin down. I'm also talking about physical changes in the brain, right? And that's why the word neuroscience is so important here. I'm talking about cellular and systemic shifts in physical brain matter. And to your question about changes over time, this is where we start to see concerns about things like various dementias, right? Or Parkinson's, right? Neurodegenerative diseases, because some of the changes that are occurring in our environment, for example, warmer weather also means that various brain disease vectors like ticks and mosquitoes are broadening their habitable range, right? Or blue-green algae are blooming at higher frequencies. And those algae blooms, unfortunately, likely release a neurotoxin that is one of the primary risk factors for something like ALS, right? Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And so these are very serious physical neurodegenerative effects. And what we know about neurodegeneration is that it takes a long time for it to manifest. You won't see the effect on day one. You're going to see it halfway through your life.
Well, I take this as a twofer. You've got the climate-fueled neurotoxin exposures from such things as increased algae bloom or and the spread of algae bloom. And then you've got side by side the climate-fueled brain diseases, which could come from them. Is there any way to be measuring this at this point, or are we just kind of putting those facts together?
That's an area of active research, right? We have surveillance systems in the United States, for example, that are tracking the whereabouts of vampire bats in northern Mexico, because vampire bats, which spread rabies, a neurological disease, are likely to increase their habitable range as a function of warming temperatures in the southern United States. And so there are people who are employed at the CDC, for example, whose whole job is to think about where these types of disease vectors end up.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Clayton Page Aldern, a senior data reporter at Grist, a Rhodes Scholar with a background in both neuroscience and public policy. He is today an environmental journalist whose work you will likely have read in such publications as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Scientific American. He's here today with The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Well, this is interesting. I didn't know that nature weighed anything. What are we talking about there, the weight of nature?
Yeah, well said. I also was not aware of the metaphor in question until it popped out of my brain. What I mean by that is nature is exerting a force on us. And this force takes many different forms. Sometimes, to me, it feels akin to a kind of pressure, right? It's a burden. It is on our shoulders. It's heavy, right? And these are the manners in which we feel things like depression or anxiety, right? Climate anxiety in response to concerns we have about a changing climate. But I think the weight of nature can be more active than that kind of burden. I also, for example, see climate change acting directly on our decision making. And that's a manner of forcing one's hand, right? That's a real active weight. So when I use the phrase the weight of nature, I'm talking both about these almost passive burdens that climate change rests on us, as well as the manners in which environmental degradation are actively influencing decision making and brain health and cognition.
Well, you're also talking about public policy. And while I have interviewed a lot of neuroscientists, most neuroscientists, if not certainly none of the ones that I spoke with before, they don't cross over into public policy. It seems to me this specifically relates to the larger picture.
I think that's right. And for me, the reason public policy is such an important part of this discussion is because that's where the decisions are being made in terms of our response societally to a changing climate. So it doesn't matter if there's a neuroscientist in her lab banging the door saying, hey, this is a problem. And it doesn't matter in terms of climate action unless somebody like a policymaker integrates her findings into their cost-benefit analyses, right? Climate action is, whether fortunately or unfortunately, predicated on a kind of cost-benefit analysis. It says we can only justify responding to climate change if the benefits of that action outweigh the costs. And my argument is that we are not readily estimating the costs if we're not taking the findings of these neuroscientists into account. If we are not pricing the neurological effects of climate change, well, it's going to be a lot harder to justify climate action simply because we're missing a big chunk of the economic pie.
You were mentioning actually Appalachia, and it's like, hey, as that climate changes and as they see differences and it impacts their mental health, there aren't enough mental health workers there to support the population. So there's a slower relationship, but that public policy has to be able to stand in. Let's go there.
Yeah, it does. I think when I reflect on the actions, both societally and individually, we might take to grapple with and respond to some of these neurological and psychological risks, to me, there is indeed a kind of joint responsibility. And in part, that's because of the dynamic that you just laid out, right? Public policy isn't going to immediately cure your depression, right? Public policy is not healthcare. It's not going to be able to treat your dementia. And so you as an individual, again, for better or for worse, you also need to be thinking about the modes of resilience with which you can engage on your own to shore up a series of defenses against these kinds of effects. And so, yes, I think it's about the relationship between something like public policy and rural mental health care access. And I think it's also incumbent on us as individuals to be aware of some of these risks such that we can meet them with grace and resilience along the way.
Well, the discussion so far does not do justice to your writing and to your storytelling. Let's talk about all the various places you've visited and been in and experienced that come forward in this book.
Well, it's a global story. Climate change doesn't care about borders, and so reporting it out, right, I couldn't either. And I think perhaps more importantly, when we're talking about neurological health, psychological health, et cetera, again, this is to a certain extent acknowledging individual contexts and regional differences, right? This is still a somewhat universal story. Everybody has a brain. And so given the fact that climate change doesn't respect borders and the presence of brains in our bodies, in effect, doesn't respect individuality. It's something we all have. This is necessarily a global universal story. And so, of course, I had to travel to tell it. When I was reporting on language loss, I thought it was going to be worth my while to talk to people in far northern Norway, right, in the Sápmi region, who have spoke directly to the implications that a changing climate has on their local language, right? This indigenous language of Northern Sami, right? It was incumbent on me to have conversations with these people to figure out what was going on beyond the headlines that I'd read elsewhere. Was it really so romantic insofar as the headlines argued climate change is causing language loss? Is it really that simple? Felt that the onus was on me to have conversations with speakers of this language to get to the bottom of the story. And likewise, we spoke earlier about community air sampling with respect to neurotoxins released by cyanobacterial blooms. I wanted to see some of these air samplers. What are these citizen scientists putting together? Because the government's not doing it. And so what is the state of the backyard science? And I'm here to tell you the backyard science is cutting edge. And there are folks in Southwest Florida who are putting together air monitoring systems that can compete with the greatest epidemiological surveillance systems that we've got out today. And I needed to see it in person.
I didn't have an appreciation for language and even the words, just the words themselves, until I read your book. You know, you'd be in one place and here's a word for the light of a particular season. You'd be in another place and here's a word for the smell that arises from the soil after the rain. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. We say, oh, you know, when something happens. I remember in the Midwest where I went to graduate school, there was that one day where after a long winter, you'd look down and you'd be somewhere unexpectedly, and there would actually be, it would be a shadow with a very straight line. You know, it's like, ooh, there's real shadow here. And everybody say, hey, did you see it? Where did you see it? What did you see it first? So our language, it depends on our environment, depends on our experience.
Oh, and in addition to depending intimately on our environment, it also shapes our perception of that environment. And this is where I think the cognitive neuroscience gets really interesting, right? There's this almost cyclical relationship between environmental change, syntactic and lexical knowledge, right? Words, vocabulary, and the ways that we deploy them, and our understanding of what reality looks like. Because if all of a sudden we learn a new word that describes some relevant aspect of our environment, putting a name to something means we can wrap our heads around it, right? And in fact, we may have just been drawn our attention may have just been drawn to something that we hadn't noticed about the world before. And so it becomes real to us in that sense, right? You used the word or hinted at the word petrichor earlier. This is the smell.
I could never have pronounced it.
emerging
from... So that's
from,
why I did that.
emerging from asphalt or from the soil after rain. Now, this is not going to be the case, but imagine a world in which all of a sudden it stops raining, right? We have so much drought, it never rains again. There'd be no need for that word in our language, and it may disappear from our knowledge of what the world is constituted by. And so if that is indeed the case, and the thing isn't happening in the world, and the word doesn't exist in our heads, well, then we're not going to have an understanding of this chunk of reality, this phenomenon. It will cease to exist for us in our minds as well. Whereas if you were to introduce that word, we now have rain again, and petrichor is a thing that is happening. All of a sudden, that richness of experience, that phenomenon, is made real to us by the fact that we can name it, right, and wrap our heads around it accordingly. We now recognize that thing as part of our experience, and our perception of reality is shaped accordingly.
And it's not about telling someone about, well, it used to rain all the time, or it used to, you have to experience it. And when we look at the people growing up today, I'm reminded of my adult son, who when he was 5 years old, walked out of the house, and it was kind of rainy, and he stopped and he goes, "What is going on? It is raining at night. It only rains during the day." You know, it's like, well, who's 5 years old? Who knew he was even paying attention?
Yes, but he was, and we are all the time. That is what brains do, right? The organ exists for us to model the world around us, right? It seeks to distinguish between ourselves and everything else, and then it seeks to ensure that we, ourselves, aren't surprised by changes in the environment that are actually constant in real time. You know, so at age 5, perhaps he'd never seen rain at night. And so his brain, his model of the world, instantiated this understanding of rain that said it only happens during the day. That was his reality. And in fact, it would have been silly for him to believe otherwise, because he'd had no evidence to the contrary. But as soon as it did rain at night, he had to integrate that new information into his model, because it did represent a surprise. And so now, with an understanding of it raining both during the day and at night, he's got a better understanding of rain writ large, that phenomenon. And that's going to guide the manner in which he navigates the world accordingly. He's not going to be surprised by rain at night.
I'm speaking with Clayton Page Aldern, the author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. We'll talk more after a break. Tech Nation programs, or simply biotech-only interviews, are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com or biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, we talk about what we know about the 70% of breast cancers which are ER-positive, HER2-negative, and all that is being done at Olema Oncology. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with environmental journalist Clayton Page Aldern, whose work in neuroscience and public policy you may know from Scientific American and The Economist. He's the author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains.
And these types of changes in our understanding of the world, especially because of something like climate change, which is forcing changes upon the world, they're occurring all the time without our knowledge.
Now, I want to ask you about this because while you didn't essentially cover it in your book, I'm dying to know. Some of humanity is denying the reality of climate change. It's just not happening. And some, on the other hand, are reacting very, very strongly to the idea of it. And you actually do write about some of these people. We're not going to have any children. You know, we're just going to have a very small imprint. How do you feel about the people who are in absolute denial of the reality of climate change? How does that fall upon you when you hear them or read them, read their words?
Well, climate change doesn't care.
That's true.
Right? So in some sense, I don't care either, right? In some sense, it doesn't matter if one denies climate change or not, because the physics of the situation are going to continue to unfurl regardless. And the reason that I am responding in this way in terms of confronting climate denial is because I think you're right. There are many folks out there for whom their opinion of climate change, their understanding of the science and of the issue, and perhaps indeed of the politics of the issue, it's never going to change, right? There's no amount of evidence that is going to shift a given quote unquote denialist's understanding of the climate. What I care about is the fact that I read a lot of research and talk to a lot of people that both indicate that there is grave reason for concern here in terms of the neurological health effects of environmental degradation. I care about the healthcare costs thereof. I care about the risks that these disease vectors are posing to people, right? Denialists or otherwise. You know, these are again, universal healthcare risks that don't really care if you believe in climate change or not. And so in some sense, I'm almost interested in pushing the question of climate change aside and instead focusing on trying to communicate the urgency of the healthcare problem with which we're faced.
And we read about this every day in one way or another. Oh, my heavens, such and such a condition is now appearing in younger and younger people, such and such a condition. There are many more than there should be for the normal population. Something has to be causing it. And certainly one contributor could certainly be climate change. I want to end with this question because I think it's important. And this is this concept of having or developing planetary empathy. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. I use the phrase to denote a kind of understanding of the very conversation you and I have just been having, right? If you accept the premise that climate change and environmental degradation are indeed forcing our hands in some respect, right? Are indeed changing us from the inside out. And you accept my argument that brains basically exist to model the world around them, then the natural conclusion of those two things is that we already empathize with the planet in literal terms. We are feeling what the planet is feeling insofar as a degrading environment degrades our brains, okay? That's an unfortunate truth. And yet I think coming to terms with it has to be part of the solution here, right? If we can recognize the intimate relationship that we already have with a changing climate, with a changing world, I think we're going to have a much easier time convincing ourselves that it is past time to act in terms of responding to a changing climate.
Clayton, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I hope you'll come back. See us again.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My guest today is Clayton Page Aldern. His book is The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. It's published by Dutton, an imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Few pieces of news are more heart-stopping than a diagnosis of cancer, as these diagnoses are most often as unexpected as they are unwelcome. It may serve us all to learn how new efforts in treating cancer are actually approached. Progress is a parallel path. It combines new insights into cancer's behavior with building more and better life-sustaining treatments in response to what's been learned. Dr. Sean Bowen takes us to where that point meets for the 70% of breast cancers which shall be diagnosed this year, a projected 240,000 cases in total. He also talks about the surprising crossover to prostate cancer. Dr. Bowen is the president and CEO of Olema Oncology. Dr. Bowen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Moira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, developing new cancer treatments are not simply about just making new shots in the dark about let's try this and that, or the same kind of shots, but slightly different. And the real progress in new cancer treatments depends upon learning more about cancer, as well as developing new tools to deal with that. And now at Olema, you are primarily focused on cancer specific to women, and your foremost programs have been a particular type, ER positive, HER2 negative, and metastatic breast cancer. Now, I think we all understand metastatic. It means the cancer cells can travel to other parts of your body. But what's ER positive and HER negative?
Yeah, so the way that breast cancer is categorized is by looking at different proteins that are expressed in the cancer cells. And so ER and HER2 are two of those particular proteins. So ER is an abbreviation for estrogen receptor. So estrogen receptor positive means when you stain the tissue, when you make the diagnosis, you see the presence of estrogen receptors. What that also then means biologically is that one of the drivers of the growth of those cancer cells is estrogen signaling through that estrogen receptor. This is an old commonly used pathway, right? So if we think about estrogen receptor, everyone has a familiar experience with how estrogen receptor causes breast cell growth and proliferation. And that is if you think of a young woman entering puberty. And what happens then is the ovaries start to secrete estrogen, which is a hormone which circulates throughout the body. It goes to the estrogen receptor in the breast tissue and other tissues that are estrogen responsive. And the turning on of that receptor turns on the growth and proliferation of the breast cells. And in puberty, that's normal breast development of a girl turning into a young woman, what we're used to thinking of. What happens in cancer, in breast cancer, what happens in many cancers is that cancer cell hijacks a normal growth and proliferation signal and uses it to grow and proliferate inappropriately. And when that happens, one of the things you want to do to try to slow down the cancer or stop it is turn that signal back off. The other, the HER2 that you mentioned is exactly a different kind of growth signal. It's actually a thing called an epidermal growth factor receptor. And so in the kinds of cancer that we're talking about, that expression is not present. But in some cancers, it is present. And then for those cancers, targeting HER2 similarly and turning off its signal is used to try to control the cancer.
Now, let me ask you this. Certainly when I was a young woman and I reached puberty and estrogen kicked in and I, you know, became a woman and I had children and all of that, I understand those estrogen receptors. But then as women mature, there's less estrogen. Well, don't the receptors go away or don't they?
The receptors do not go away. And it is absolutely true that there is less estrogen. Again, the common experience that people will point to with regard to that is menopause, right? Menopause is the ovaries significantly reducing, although not necessarily completely stopping estrogen production. So postmenopausal breast cancer still is often ER positive, HER2 negative. ER positive, HER2 negative is the most common form of breast cancer. It's about 70% of breast cancer diagnoses. And realizing that the median age in the US of diagnosis for breast cancer is 62 years of age. So many of the women diagnosed with breast cancer have the estrogen receptor and are also postmenopausal, but there are other sources of estrogen in the body in addition to the ovaries. For instance, the progestins, the male, typically considered male hormones that can be produced in the body, can be converted by enzymes in your body into estrogens. So that then remains one of the main sources of estrogen after that primary ovarian production has decreased in menopause.
And so with these cancers, these breast cancers, the cancers have gotten enthusiastic about those estrogen receptors again?
Yeah. They've become, they have, what will happen is there's this growth and proliferation signal. And of course, in a normal cell, if we go back to that breast development in puberty example, the cell has other signals that come in that say, okay, that's enough growth and proliferation. This is when you're supposed to stop. You've reached a certain volume. You have enough contact with other cells. We're going to turn that down, right? And so it's a kind of checks and balances. It's a little bit of a foot on the gas with the estrogen receptor, a foot on the brake with some other growth slowing or halting signals. That cancer keeps the foot on the gas and disables the brakes.
There you go.
And that's where you run into this situation of the uninhibited, uncontrolled cellular growth and proliferation of the cancer.
And that becomes the tumor.
Indeed.
That becomes the tumor. So let's talk about your lead compound, which is in phase three, the final phase. And I should say you're also working in earlier phases in combination with other treatments from Novartis and from Pfizer. But let's start with this most advanced, this phase three, and your compound itself. I mean, I really like how your website described it. The compound was developed to completely antagonize the estrogen receptor. Now, that has an everyday English appeal. I mean, if you antagonize me, I'll finally just throw my hands up and go away. But what does antagonize mean scientifically?
Right. So scientifically, in this case, it means turn off completely. And in this case, what the estrogen receptor does molecularly is it turns on the expression of genes that produce proteins that promote the cellular growth and proliferation, okay? And so what we do by binding our compound, which is called palazestrin, it binds to the estrogen receptor where estrogen would normally bind. But instead of turning it into an active growth and proliferation signal, it locks it in an inactive conformation and just shuts it off completely. And that's our way of depriving the cancer cell of that ER-mediated growth and proliferation, depriving the cancer cell of that ER-mediated growth and proliferation signal.
So that estrogen, which is driving this tumor in the cancerous condition, it can't get in because the estrogen receptor has been blocked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it'll get into the cell, but when it goes to the estrogen receptor itself, it will find the place where it binds is occupied, and occupied by palazestrant, which not only blocks the binding of the estrogen, but basically holds the receptor in an inactive conformation. Now, as the cancer advances, the cell gets even craftier about this. And one of the most common mutations, okay, so a change in the protein that occurs as the breast cancer advances, is the cancer cell changes the estrogen receptor protein to turn it on without any estrogen being present.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's nasty. Yeah.
It is. It is. And that is the most common mechanism whereby the cancer progresses again after the patient is treated with another class of drug called a CDK4/6 inhibitor, plus a class of drug that decreases estrogen production. That's what today is given when you're first diagnosed. It's quite effective. But patients eventually find that their disease progresses. And about half the time, if you go look at that progressing tumor, what you find is that that estrogen receptor has been turned on by a change in the protein. Here's the great thing, though. Palazestrant binds that form of the receptor, too. And when it binds that form of the receptor, it pushes it back into the inactive conformation and again starves the breast cancer cell of that growth and proliferation signal coming from the estrogen receptor.
Now you're in phase three, that final phase. Tell us about that. Who is in it? What's the state of their cancer? How many people? What's it like for the women in the trial? Would you like me to think up 72 more questions? Just tell me, do you have enough questions there? We want to know about this trial.
Yeah. Right. No, so the phase, it's very exciting for us to be in phase three. And as you mentioned, Moira, this is the last phase of developing a drug that leads to, of course, if the trial's positive, shows a benefit for patients, that leads to being able to file an application with the regulatory authorities, the FDA in the United States, and then hopefully get approval and offer this therapy to cancer patients more broadly. Obviously, the journey there takes a while. Palazestrant has been used to treat more than 300 ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer patients to date. With very encouraging data, both as a monotherapy, right? So this is a pill that you take one time daily. You don't go to an infusion center. It's not an IV medication. You take a pill once a day. And so one of the objectives is not only to slow the progression of the cancer, to keep it from coming back, but also to make sure that the patients taking this medicine have a nice quality of life. This is very important, right? You want to enjoy, be able to enjoy and feel well. And so that's a nice property as well. The ongoing phase three trial is called OPERA-01. So the OPERA-01 trial will enroll patients who are considered second or third line of therapy. That means they got the standard first line therapy, and then their tumors progressed. And so the patients will be randomized, with half of the patients getting our antagonist therapy, which is an oral daily pill. And then the other half will get the existing standard of care, which is two different classes of therapy. Some of them are oral daily pills, some are injections. And then we'll follow those patients to see if and when their cancer then progresses again. So that's the primary endpoint of the trial. We believe this trial will read out, our kind of top line readout will be in 2026.
Ooh, wild.
It's enrolling right now. It's a global trial all over the world. So the combination that we're most focused on is with CDK4/6 inhibitors. There are two of those we've studied, one of which is from Pfizer, one of which is a Novartis drug. And those are the drugs that are used in this first line setting. So what we're trying to do there is show that in the first line setting, when you're first diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, that we can do better than the existing standard of care that targets the estrogen, which is the aromatase inhibitor class. That drug class decreases estrogen production in the body, but it doesn't bind the estrogen receptor at all. The problem with that is when these changes arise that turn the receptor on, the aromatase inhibitors don't have any effect. So with the Olema drug, palazestrant, we believe we're going to be able to stop that mechanism of resistance and progression by locking the receptor in an inactive conformation, regardless of whether it has this change to make it estrogen independent or not.
Now, I should say there's a lot more to what Olema is doing. You have efforts in other types of breast cancer, in endometrial cancer, and even in prostate cancer. You know, from what we've talked about today, what is the commonality?
Yeah, that's such a fantastic question, because the commonality is different in those different types of cancer. So in the gynecological cancers, of which endometrial or cervical cancer is an example, those are also, as you'll appreciate, tissues where estrogen receptor is active in normal physiology, right? And so those tumors sometimes use the estrogen receptor growth and proliferation signal inappropriately, as ER-positive breast cancer does. So we haven't started the trials there yet, but we are examining how might we approach using a complete estrogen receptor antagonist to approach those gynecological cancers. And the prostate cancer role is something a bit different. That's a different target. So we have a program that we will enter the clinic late this year or early next toward a different type of target, and that's called KAT6, K-A-T number 6. And that is a protein that changes the structure of what's called the chromatin. It's how the DNA is folded up in your cells. And it just so happens that the KAT6 chromatin modifying agent affects targets of hormone receptors. So in the breast, it's the estrogen receptor. In the prostate, it's the androgen receptor. And so the overlap is because this chromatin modifying agent actually interacts with both of these hormone receptors.
So it's good for everything.
I wouldn't quite go that far, but
we hope so. I hope so.
it is a fascinating intersection of biology. And in an ideal world, what we would be able to do, because we know that that palazestrant, the estrogen receptor antagonist, combines well with other drugs. In an ideal world, we would find a way to combine it with KAT6 as well, and then give another new therapeutic option for patients with breast cancer.
So we've come back to the beginning in that we're learning more about cancer, and we're developing new tools which feed right into what we are learning about cancer.
It's absolutely true that there is a somewhat iterative aspect of this, right? You find out, you know, estrogen receptor is actually an old cancer treatment target. Tamoxifen was approved in 1977, right? So the concept that this was a way you could treat cancer has actually been around for quite a while and is very well demonstrated. But as you learn more about it, you say, we're making a difference. We're treating the cancer and having an effect, but we're learning that we're not doing it quite as well as we possibly could. So then you go in and you change your approach and you try something new. And that's how you get from tamoxifen, which does not completely turn off the estrogen receptor, to saying, okay, we want to turn it off completely now. And so you refine that approach. And obviously the objective is really straightforward, which is to keep people alive longer with a high quality of life, and be able to treat these cancers. And so that's the end game here.
Now, I learned something interesting about Olema when I was working on this interview. And I have to say, in biotech, when we say, oh, we're a company from San Francisco, we're really saying South San Francisco. That's where the big cluster is, you know, of all these companies, you know, right there. On the whole San Francisco Bay Area has many companies in it, but right, it usually means South San Francisco. You're actually in San Francisco. How can that be?
Yeah, we are. We are. There are a few of us. We're not the only one, but we are based in the city of San Francisco. Our lab space is on Brannan Street. Our office space is on Owens, very near the UCSF Mission Bay campus. And it's just for us, it's a very exciting place to be. Obviously, there's the Bay Area biotech hub, which is exciting. We, for instance, have clinical trials enrolling patients across the street, which is kind of exciting. We do also, I have to say, you have to acknowledge this as well. We also have a very important office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so we get access to all the great talent and knowledge in the Cambridge Boston biotech hub as well.
Well, I have to say, you like your bio clusters.
Yep, we do.
You're right in the middle of those. Well, Dr. Bowen, this has really been terrific. I really appreciate you coming in, and I hope you'll come back and keep us updated.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to provide an update. And thank you, Moira. It's really exciting to get to share the story and the progress that we're making. And hopefully when I come back, we'll talk about, you know, how there's a promising new therapy for breast cancer patients.
Dr. Sean Bowen is the president and CEO of Olema Oncology. More information is available on the web at olema.com. That's O-L-E-M-A, olema.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.